Good morning. Can you hear me there? Can you hear me? Okay. Okay, thanks. Good morning. Welcome to Sunday School. Welcome to Adult Sunday School. Let's begin with prayer. Father, we thank you for another day. We thank you for another Lord's Day where we can rest. We thank you that you've given your people rest, that you do not call us to work 7 days a week. Help us to actually enjoy and glorify you in this rest today. And now help us to learn more about you and how we can glorify you throughout all of the days of the week. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Well, welcome back, or welcome for the first time. If you've not been here, we are during this term of Sunday School covering some of the life of J. Gresham Machen and then reading together. I hope you'll be reading together with me his classic book, Christianity and Liberalism. What we've covered so far, this is the third session in this class. In the first session, I discussed with you why we should read this book, because it's influential, it's relevant, it's beneficial, and it's accessible. It's free. If you want to get it for free online, you can do that, and it's not too difficult to read. So I encourage you to read it. In the second session, we covered why the book was written, especially why it was written when it was written in the 1920s. And we looked at what was going on in the fundamentalist modernist controversy at that time. We covered a little bit, very little bit, about what liberal theology was, what Machen was writing to argue against. That type of approach to theology, which was trying to use the name Christianity, and Machen was arguing it was actually not Christianity, was growing in influence and popularity, not just in the world at large, but even in the church. And it wanted, the leaders of it, wanted the church to accommodate to what were currently, at that time, the modern ideas and sentiments, especially things related to science and progress and things of that nature. So the thinking was, we want people to remain in church, we want people to continue to do kind of the good works that are associated with Christianity, but if that's going to happen, we're going to have to change some of what the message of Christianity is. Machen thought that was a bad idea. I hope you'll think that was a bad idea. He thought that was a bad idea, and he sided with the fundamentalists in opposing liberal theology's attempts to accommodate the culture at that time. He didn't like being called a fundamentalist. He didn't think their project was thorough enough, but he was willing to make common cause with them because he thought liberal theology was, in fact, another religion. It wasn't even a perversion of Christianity. It was entirely different. So that's what we've seen so far. This week, what we want to try to look at is who wrote the book. A little bit about who wrote this book, Christianity and Liberalism. We've already many times said that, well, obviously the author's name is J. Gresham Machen. He lived from 1881 to 1937. But today let's look a little bit more at who was he? What was it about him, perhaps, that led to him writing this book and to it being as influential as it's been? If we get there today, we may not get through both of these points. We'll see how time goes. But we can then also look at who did he influence. So kind of where did he come from? What was his background? Where was he coming from? And then who did he influence in his life's work? Not just with this book, but with several of the things that he did with his life. But as we do this, I think it's very important that we avoid two different errors. One we'll call hagiography, and the other, using a term from C.S. Lewis, we'll call bulwarism. For those who may be wondering what's hagiography, the word just comes from the Greek word hagios, which is related to holiness or to being holy. Original hagiographies were literally biographies of saints, biographies of the holy people. Today we use the term more broadly, usually actually in a critical sense, that it's a biography that idealizes its subject, removes all their faults, emphasizes only on their good aspects. And it's a kind of hero worship, and usually it's done to serve a pre-existing agenda. And it might make us feel good, and it might be useful if we have some sort of agenda, but it's not usually related to truth, and so ultimately will not be helpful for us. So Machen was a man, a great man, I think, by anyone's measure, who accomplished many great things, and in many ways, I hope we will actually agree with him. But he wasn't perfect, and the point of this Sunday school class isn't let's be like Machen. Now, obviously, when anyone is doing the right thing, well, let's be like them. But it's not let's be like them so that God will love us. Let's be like them and all the problems will go away in the world. That's neither of those is going to happen. But what can we learn from him, even as an imperfect person, as we are imperfect people, that we might be able to apply to our lives as we seek to glorify God? So what's Bulverism? So hagiography would be this idol worship, hero worship. Bulverism is a term coined by C.S. Lewis in 1941 or around then. For the logic people in here, it's a combination of begging the question and the genetic fallacy. Begging the question, you might also call it circular reasoning. It's when you start, you assume your conclusion as you begin to argue. And I'll read some Lewis on this, and he'll say it more clearly than I can and more entertainingly than I can. But it's circular reasoning combined with the genetic fallacy, which is to say the genetic fallacy is to argue that because you know why someone said what they said or who is saying it, that you then also can refute or affirm their conclusion. In other words, who it is what you're looking at, not what the argument actually is. If you don't care about those logic terms, probably won't make any difference in your life, but the concepts will make a big difference in your life. We want to avoid this kind of circular reasoning. We want to avoid what is called the genetic fallacy, and combining those in what Lewis calls Bulverism. So he thought that it was characteristic of the 20th century. Seems to me it's not gotten better in the 21st century. It's gotten worse. It's a way to villainize an author, usually to serve a pre-existing agenda. So both of these can be used and are used as propaganda tools in different directions, right? And I think we want to avoid both of them as we look at our heroes. So I would say for many people, probably in this room, even Machen would legitimately be a hero, but we don't want to make him into a little god. That would ruin his effectiveness in our lives, and he wouldn't even appreciate it. So here's how Lewis talks about Bulverism. If you want to read his whole essay, the essay is titled Bulverism, and you can find it in the book that contains many of his essays that's called God in the Dock. The version I have at home was published in 1971. The essays are older than that. I think that was the first edition of that book, was 1971, but it's easy to find if you want it. The essay is about 4 pages, maybe, something like that. But here's a little excerpt from it. This is Lewis. You must show that a man is wrong before you start explaining why he is wrong. The modern method is to assume, without discussion, that he's wrong and then distract his attention from this, which is the only real issue, by busily explaining how he became so silly. In the course of the last 15 years, I've found this vice so common that I've had to invent a name for it. I call it Bulverism. Someday I'm going to write the biography of its imaginary inventor, Ezekiel Bulver, whose destiny was determined at the age of 5 when he heard his mother say to his father, who had been maintaining that 2 sides of a triangle were together greater than a third, "Oh, you say that because you're a man." At that moment, E. Bulver assures us, there flashed across my opening mind the great truth that refutation is no necessary part of argument. Assume that your opponent is wrong and explain his error, and the world will be at your feet. Attempt to prove that he is wrong, or worse still, try to find out whether he is wrong or right, and the national dynamism of our age will thrust you to the wall. That is how Bulwer became one of the makers of the 20th century. Instead of that, Lewis is going to tell us kind of probably what we should do. Suppose I think after doing my accounts, after balancing his checkbook, after doing my accounts, I think I have a large balance at the bank. And suppose you want to find out whether this belief of mine is wishful thinking. You can never come to any conclusion by examining my psychological condition. Your only chance of finding out is to sit down and work through the sum yourself. When you have checked my figures, then and then only will you know whether I have that balance or not. If you find my arithmetic correct, then no amount of vaporing about my psychological condition can be anything but a waste of time. If you find my arithmetic wrong, then it may be relevant to explain psychologically how I came to be so bad at my arithmetic, and the doctrine of the concealed wish will become relevant. But only after you have yourself done the sum and discovered me to be wrong on purely arithmetical grounds. It is the same with all thinking and all systems of thought. If you try to find out which are tainted by speculating about the wishes of the thinkers, you are merely making a fool of yourself. You must first find out on purely logical grounds which of them do, in fact, break down as arguments. Afterwards, if you like, go on and discover the psychological causes of the error. So today we're going to go about this backwards. We're not reading Machen's arguments first, unless you've read ahead, which is great. We're looking a little bit about his history and his psychology beforehand. But as we do that, we need to keep these things in mind. The fact of who he is, what team he's on, doesn't mean he's right. If he's on our, he's on our team. Also, if we find some things that we disagree with him from the past, it doesn't mean the arguments in the book are wrong. I still think that we can find it useful, especially if we didn't know a lot about him before reading the book, to kind of know, again, along with the context that we got historically from the past. So let's, if we can, let's look at him without turning him into a saint, a hagiography, or without trying to dismiss him, look a little bit at his life. Who was he? Well, we've already seen theologically that he was not a liberal, not a fundamentalist, but a confessionalist, and someone who wanted to perpetuate not just the solas of the Reformation, not just TULIP, the distinctives of Calvinist soteriology, not just the five fundamentals that the Presbyterian Church adopted. He wanted to say that those, while he would have affirmed all of those, and those are all good, we should have a more thorough, a more complete confession. And he was willing and, in fact, did spend his life trying to advocate for that entire Westminster Confession. We covered some of that last week. So who was he confessionally? Now, this is a huge topic, and I'm not probably even the best qualified to cover that with you, and we don't have enough time to go to it in depth. We could spend the whole 12 sessions probably on different views of confessionalism and talking about where Machen fits in that spectrum, and we're not going to do that today, but we'll try to get some sense of where he lands and what he was trying to do beyond this book. The book is just, as I've mentioned before, and if you've started reading, you'll see, is really making one argument. Historic Christianity and liberalism are two entirely different religions. So he's not going into great depths into confessional details, but it still is part of his motivating agenda, part of what was in his workings as he was doing these things was, we want to defend historic Christianity, but not only some sort of minimal, very minimal skeletal creed, but a full, thorough, historically situated creed that would give full life and function to our church. So when we talk about confessional positions and confessionalism, it gets very difficult to do because, and we laugh, but this is actually a real chart. Some people cry when they see this, and some people laugh, but in fact, there's not only this chart. This, if you want to see this and where you can actually see it, because I'm sure you can't read that very well, you can go onto the PCUSA website, pcusa.org. That'd be the Liberal Presbyterian Church, so I'm not advocating that you spend a lot of time there, but this chart is there. Or you can Google it, and you can find this chart very easily. But there are many others. Here's another one. I'm sure you can't read that one. That one was by some guy named Cameron Schaefer. You can Google it and see it. That one not only has Presbyterian family tree, but also the Dutch Reformed, the German Reformed, and breaks out the difference between the English Presbyterians and the Scottish Presbyterians. And then another one that's available at the PCUSA.org is this one. Again, you can't see it at all, so why did I bother? I kind of put it up here just so you could know. If you're interested, you can easily look this stuff up, and you can search it out and learn about it. But if we go back to the first one, you can at least, I can probably point out to you something. Up here, can you see the little red thing? So up here, these are the early Presbyterians in the United States. So I think like 1706 or something, they show up. And they're Brits, right? Down here are some Presbyterians that show up later. They're usually Scottish. And so then some of them were Covenanters and some of them were seceders. And we're not going to get into all of that today. But what we have to keep in mind at all times is each of these different trees would have in slightly different attitudes towards different confessional questions. They would all share the Westminster Confession, but have different attitudes about how strict we need to be with it, how many people need to subscribe to it, what that subscription means, etc. Beyond that, as it relates to Machen, you will be able to sort of see here that this line, at the time of the Civil War, not just Presbyterians, but most of the denominations split into Northern and Southern. And so we have a Northern Presbyterian branch and a Southern Presbyterian branch. They had slightly different attitudes toward confessional questions. And if you want to study this more, you can see there's things you'll hear about. Back here, you might sometime hear about the old side, new side debate. That had to do with people's attitudes confessionally and institutionally related to the First Great Awakening. And I'm way oversimplifying stuff here, but that's what we need to do, right? We're getting an overview, we're getting a stream and a throw. Interesting, I didn't have time to study it much today, but what surprised me, I'd known about this split. They get back together, I think, within 14 years or something. Like, when do people do that? That's great, right? They get back together. That's about the First Great Awakening. There's then another division about confessional identity and how the church should function called the old school, new school split. It gets really confusing because you got old side, new side, old school, new school. And that happens around questions at the Second Great Awakening. So these questions really are related to, what do you think about revivals and revivalism, and what do you think is the role of the institutional church and the confessions as opposed to parachurch ministries and kind of broad evangelicalism? So keeping that in mind and seeing how that all gets tangled, you could say we're not going to be able to give a thorough answer to the confessional questions today, but we can maybe get some broad kind of flow of history idea about where he's coming from. So Machen himself grew up in Baltimore. He lived in Baltimore, but his mother was a Southern Presbyterian, and she raised him in a church in Baltimore that was a part of the Southern Presbyterian denomination. His father, I think, was Episcopalian, but I think went to church with them at the Presbyterian church. But regardless, his mother catechized him with the Westminster Catechism, raised him in the Southern Presbyterian Church. Confessionally, the Southern Presbyterian Church at that time had, at least around where the connections he had, probably had some leanings that were more open to the new school side of these confessional debates. But after he grew up, actually before going to Princeton Seminary, he went to Johns Hopkins University, which interestingly was the most kind of modern of the American universities at the time. It was the kind of modern scientific university was Hopkins. So he's kind of gone to the Southern Presbyterian Church. He's not so sure what he thinks about all of this religion stuff and being a minister. He goes to Hopkins as a Greek student there, as a very good Greek student. After that, though, he's not sure what to do, so he goes to Princeton Seminary. Princeton Seminary was a part of the Northern Presbyterian Church, and at the time he went, the leaders and the people that mentored him would have been more on the old school side of these confessional ideas, confessional conflicts or disagreements. After graduating from Princeton Seminary, he went to Germany and studied with a famous liberal scholar. So I mention these things to say, is this guy, as he writes this book, this is not someone who's just saying, hey, I learned from my mom, and I'm going to perpetuate what my mom taught me. There's new ideas coming in. I don't want to hear these new ideas. He actually really wrestled with these new ideas. In fact, was attracted to them. In fact, considered adopting the liberal ideas for a time in Germany while studying there. Was very impressed with his teacher. And from this, I think, is one of the reasons we'll see as you read the book, while he strongly, clearly, overtly disagrees with the liberals, he usually, in fact, I don't know if ever there's an exception, he does not dehumanize them. He says that he understands why people would wrestle with these ideas and these questions. And he says that he can even respect and admire people who will honestly and openly adopt them. What he's really upset about is that they're adopting these ideas but not being honest about it, covering it up, trying to make it look like they're not changing things when in fact they're changing everything. After he came back from Germany, he first as a teaching assistant, later as a full faculty member, joined the faculty at Princeton Seminary and became a part. He abandons any consideration of personally adopting liberal theology for himself and joins this old school confessional group. So this is a group that leaned against kind of modern American revivalist techniques, leaned toward more thorough confessional subscription and traditional Presbyterian approach to spirituality. That's about all I'm going to cover on that. If you want to know more about confessionalism, maybe Chris or the elders can teach a class on confessionalism someday. But it is something that continues to be a debate and a discussion even in our denomination, not to mention in discussions amongst denominations of what is thoroughgoing confessionalism, what degree should it guide what we do, etc. But what we need to know about Machen was he was definitely on the side of strong subscription There's some terms today that are used about these things that I don't know if they existed at the time, but he would have been strongly in favor of thoroughgoing subscription to the Westminster Confession, and that confession should guide. And he actually, in various places, just calls it the confession of the Presbyterian Church. Right? He just says, this is our church's confession, and I believe it. That's why I'm a minister in this church, and this is what we need to seek to advocate and live out in the world. So, confessionally, that's who he was. Who was he personally? Well, he was a gifted scholar and a leader. At the same time, a flawed human being, as we would have to say about anyone who we talked about in this class, anyone except Christ himself. He was from a wealthy, connected family in Baltimore. So his father was a lawyer. His mother was from a wealthy family as well. She was quite a scholar herself. They had very influential people in their home. I couldn't find a reference to it this week, but I'm fairly sure they had Woodrow Wilson, the president, in their home. I'm not sure if it was before he was president. You need to remember, Wilson himself was a Southern Presbyterian. He became a liberal, adopted liberal theology. But they were connected to academics, artists, and politicians of great influence. And he grew up in that kind of home, with servants and with wealthy, influential people. He was a Democrat, a libertarian, and had sympathies, sympathies to the South in the questions over the Civil War. You need to keep in mind, and you need to study it much more yourself, but the Democrat Party and the Republican Party at the time were very different than they are today. They, in some cases, had almost opposite positions on things than they have today. But he, I think, in his own personal views about government action in our lives, government involvement in our lives, was much more of a libertarian even than his political party. And we'll see it in the book. The book is not about politics, but we'll see he's challenged, and he's responding to challenges. Is why would we want this kind of strict adherence to a confession of faith or to a historic idea of Christianity, but yet you want a lot more freedom in the country? You don't want to regulate things by the government as much. And we'll see in the book, you say, well, in America, you can't avoid being a citizen. If you're a citizen here, you could leave the country. But wherever you are, you cannot escape being a part of civil society. In America, however, the church is a voluntary organization. You don't have to join the Presbyterian Church. So because it's voluntary, if you think that the Presbyterian confession is wrong, we'll go find a church where you think the confession is right. You have that freedom. Therefore, we can be more clear about what we are for and what we believe, whereas in the country where everyone has to be a part of it, we need to be constraining people's conscience and their freedom much less. So he had those sympathies and those views, and they were tied. Again, if we wanted to commit the genetic fallacy, we could say, well, of course he did. His mom was from the South, and you know, he was rich. You can make all of these arguments, and some of that would have some validity, but do those things play into everything he believed in a way that was automatic? That would be the fallacy. He had a personality that only his friends enjoyed. So early on, I read that, like, who doesn't? Who isn't that true of? You know? I mentioned early on in the first or second class that I thought one of the virtues of the book, and one of the reasons I think it's good we're reading it now, is that he was clear, courageous, and courteous. And I think when you read the book, I think you'll agree. If you don't, we can have a debate about it. But I think you'll agree. That doesn't necessarily mean that he was always pleasant in person. Apparently, even one of the jobs in Princeton that he was up for, professor of apologetics, he was passed over because the committee thought that his personality had too many idiosyncrasies. In fact, I think, here's a quote from a talk John Piper gave on this one time. He seemed to have a personality that alienated people too easily. The committee that did not recommend him to the chair of apologetics at Princeton referred to his temperamental idiosyncrasies. He seemed to have a flaring temper and a propensity to make strong remarks about individuals with whom he disagreed. So I mentioned that to say, you know, the guy's not perfect. But I still will say, going back here, is like, who doesn't have a personality that only their friends enjoy? Another thing we have to mention today is that it's come to light in recent years that he was sometimes in favor of segregation. He opposed racial integration of the dorms at Princeton Seminary when this was coming up. Now we know, this is where I think we should avoid the genetic fallacy, we know that this is not a feature of his old school confessionalism, because his mentor, B.B. Warfield, was the one proposing and pushing and in favor of the integration. And so this was an argument between two men, and we can debate who was living consistently with their confessional beliefs. I would say that Warfield was correct in this case, and Machen was wrong. He was wrong in a way that's typical of his context. I almost deleted that because that can often be used as just a dodge. Well, it doesn't matter because everybody was like that back then. Well, I left it because it's true. In his social class, from his where his family was from in the country, the blind spots he had in this case, the blind spot he had was not unusual. But that doesn't mean it was right, and it doesn't mean it was a foregone conclusion that he would have that view. Others in his confessional tradition were not wrong in the same way. So we can't say that Westminster Confession Presbyterianism causes you to believe in segregationism. That would be a completely invalid argument to make. And we also could say, well, I have no desire at all to defend his position on this. It is wrong. Straight up wrong. If he was here, I'd say you were wrong. But we do need to keep in mind, he did not spend his time publicly advocating for this. There's no books, there's no public journal articles that I've been able to find where he does this. Most of the current attention being given to this topic is from one or two letters that he wrote to his mother. And which, again, they're wrong, but man, would you like everybody to read your private letters? Would there be anything in there that might be embarrassing 100 years later? But he didn't advocate for it publicly. He didn't leave Princeton over this. So this is a guy who is willing to leave places, to give up positions of privilege for his principles. He did not leave Princeton Seminary over it. He did not prevail. Warfield had more power and influence than he did, and they did integrate the seminary. In fact, interestingly, it had been integrated previously. I don't know what happened that it got unintegrated, and it was being reintegrated at this time, and Machen did not prevail in his arguments with Warfield, and yet he remained at Princeton, did not leave over this issue. When he finally resigned, it was over the restructuring of the seminary, which allowed liberal professors to be on faculty. And we mentioned that a little bit last time. So there was this restructuring going on. Machen, Warfield, and others wanted only people who could affirm the confession, people who were real Christians who really believed in the historic Christian faith to be on faculty. But the restructuring allowed people who were of the liberal theology persuasion to be on the faculty, and at that time, Machen left. So it would be hagiography if I would have left that out and not mentioned his error in this case. And of course, if we had lots of time, I'm sure there are many other errors he could have. But in our day and age, this one would seem like, whoa, that's the big error. why did we not mention it? We mentioned it. He's not a sinless saint. He had a mistake here. But it would be bulverism to think that all of Machen's positions and arguments are wrong because he was wrong on this one. So let's look a little bit at his influence. So that's a little bit who he was. From a wealthy home, from Baltimore, went to Hopkins, went to Princeton. Very intelligent, studied in seminaries over in Germany, wrestled with liberalism, rejected it not because he wasn't familiar with it, but because he was familiar with it. Yes, he had some real serious problems on his views on segregation and integration. But overall, you know, he was in some ways a man of his time. In some ways, he was a man who changed the times. So who did he influence? Who was he around? What were the results of what he did? Well, one of them was that he founded Westminster Seminary to carry on old Princeton. So as we said, that when they reorganized the seminary to allow liberals to teach, Machen resigned. Machen and several others resigned, and they went to found Westminster Seminary. And their desire was to carry on what they called Old Princeton. In fact, he, in his inaugural address, he calls it that. We're going to carry on Old Princeton because Old Princeton over at Princeton has died. But we're going to keep it alive here at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. So this was a huge undertaking. He was in his 50s at the time and persuaded several other faculty members from Princeton to come with him. And they started a new seminary. Becomes one of the most influential seminaries in the United States since that time. We'll see some of that as we move forward. He also, a bit later, founds the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. You may hear people refer to the OPC. That's the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. This time he didn't leave the Presbyterian denomination. So you have to see, he was both an ordained minister and a professor at Princeton. He gave up being professor at Princeton on his own because he was unwilling to work in that context. He didn't leave being an ordained minister in the Northern Presbyterian Church on his own. They helped him leave. They showed him the door. They defrocked him, it's called. They removed his frock. He was no longer a man of the cloth in their denomination. They did this because, however, he had founded a mission board called the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions. He founded this because, like the seminary had begun to allow liberal professors, the mission agency of the Northern Presbyterian Church was sending out liberal missionaries. And Machen and his colleagues thought this was a scandal. Our church is sending people to evangelize who don't believe the evangel, right? That we're sending people to spread the gospel who think the gospel is just to do good works, to tell everyone that God is our Father and we're all brothers and let's be happy and do good things. He said this actually will send everyone to hell and it's not loving at all, and we shouldn't be allowing this. When he was unable to persuade the denomination to only send Orthodox, Bible-believing, evangelical, confessional people to the mission field, he started his own mission agency, not his own personally, but a separate mission agency that would require all of the missionaries to actually be real Christians, as he would have said it. Now, if we again had more time to talk about the confessional thing, this is actually a very non-old school thing to do. And the reason they defrocked him was one of the old school principles was that things like missions, all of these kind of Christian activities, ought to come from the church directly, from the denomination. They should not be separate parachurch organizations. This is one of the things. So he's starting, in essence, a parachurch organization, and the denomination said, you need to stop starting another parachurch organization to do something that our church already has an organization to do is insubordination. You're not being faithful to your ordination vows. And if we want to go by legal things on that point, they were right. And by his own old school views of the confession, they were right. I think he would have said, yeah, but that you guys quit being Christians, right? So he was trying to get them to say, you're being right on a point of legality when the larger point isn't true. Now, it is interesting, and I'm sure there are scholars that have used a lot of ink writing about this, but it's interesting that the guy who in our time is often most associated with, at least in recent times, with this kind of old school position is the person who starts a type of organization that would have been what a new school kind of person would do. But I think we can't ask him, and I wasn't able to find where he commented on this directly. That doesn't mean it's not out there. That means in 1 week I wasn't able to find it. I think he would say, well, I don't want to do this, but you've given me no choice. When they defrock him, he then goes on to found the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, in essence, to continue on the old and continue the old Northern Presbyterian Church. And it's called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. It still exists today. In fact, at one time in the history of Trinity was an Orthodox Presbyterian Church for a brief period of time before switching to the PCA. If you want all the details, see Carl afterwards. He can tell you. Maybe Randy Kinnick. I don't know who else would have been around. But Karen. Well, Karen too. Yes. Oh, yes. 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 I was speaking, you know, as your covenantal head there, you were speaking. He also had great influence with many colleagues and students who went on to influence many other denominations and seminaries and ministries. So one of the things I want to try to do is, this is a little bit simpler, and maybe you can follow this than that previous. Is that a little bit simpler than that one I showed you before? Let's see. Here we go. So you can see, now for those of you that are scholars and real historians, this is way oversimplified, meaning it's so oversimplified that in some cases it's inaccurate, but it's overall, I believe it's true. If you tell me it's so wrong, to so simplify that it's no longer true, I'll correct it next week, but let me know. But I think this is in broad brushstrokes accurate, right? So Machen was in the Northern Church up here. The Southern Church is going on just fine, too. I'll mention this when we get to somewhere else. This isn't just happening to Presbyterians. We're good at splitting, but we're not the only ones. These things were happening with lots of denominations. When Machen leaves, when Machen gets left, they kick him out, he founds with other people. He doesn't do this on his own. I don't want to give the impression, I don't think he's like these some of our contemporary people who become enamored with themselves and just big names, and it's all about them and they have to be in total control on their own. He was big. He did probably fill the room. He was definitely leading, but he was always doing this with other ministers and people with him. Westminster Seminary actually was founded before the OPC, so I should have put it up here, but it's alongside the OPC. It's not officially a denominational seminary. It's independent, but they cooperate quite a bit, and it's still going on, both of them. Not very long after they formed the OPC, I think it's only like a year, maybe two. Machen doesn't live very long after this. He passes away because, like we said before, he came to the frozen tundra and died. But he came to the Dakotas and dies. But when that happens, as often happens, he was holding together a lot of disparate viewpoints on many different things. And especially when he and his friends left Princeton, And then when he got kicked out of the denomination, other Reformed and Presbyterian people who were feeling embattled in their context, in their denominations, started to join them. So we had lots of kind of different emphases, different personalities, different agendas coming together. And when Machen dies, these agendas, there's no one to hold these agendas together or work out the differences, and a split occurs. And one of the first is this Bible Presbyterian Church is founded. Faith Seminary is also founded. Like Westminster, Faith is not officially part of the Bible Presbyterian Church, but it was closely associated with it. A few years later, and we'll see why when I show you some names here in a minute, I'll say this split had to do with, if you remember I said before, Machen and the more confessional people weren't so interested in some of the American fundamentalist emphases. This group was a little bit more interested in those. This group wanted to be premillennial, wanted to not allow beverage use of alcohol, wanted to not allow smoking. They wanted what had become more American fundamentalist shibboleths, American fundamentalist cultural markers in their group. And this group wanted to stay a bit more true, I think, to what Machen had been trying to do. So this group splits and they form Faith Seminary. A few years later, though, this group, they become known for being very cantankerous, very militant, would have been the pop, you know, the word of affirmation they would have used. Well, we're very militant. But they became very, they fought with each other a lot. Francis Schaeffer was a part of this group. It's why he ends up leaving over time, and many of them do. So when some of them come to realize, we are being too cantankerous, too militant, too embattled all of the time, it broke off. Now, here's where I'm oversimplifying it. It went through a couple other versions, but it went to what was temporarily called the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, and it merged with some people who were coming up from the Reformed Presbyterian Church, from the Covenanters. But we're just going to skip all that and say it ends up being the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod. This, in fact, was then the group that in 1982... merges with the PCA. So the PCA leaves the Southern Presbyterian Church in, what, 73, something like that? And then 82, the RPCES joins them. Blah, blah, blah. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, I'm going to show you that Machen had influence in all of these streams, and then out of Faith Seminary, there's influence into even non-Presbyterian streams. So I know at our church there's lots of people, myself included, who didn't grow up in Presbyterianism. And you say, well, so what does all of this mean? Well, you were influenced most likely, if you were in any of the American evangelical churches, by Machen or one of Machen's students, or this book, no matter what stream you happened to find yourself in. This is just a screenshot of all the notable faculty and all the of some of the notable faculty and some of the notable alumni from Westminster Seminary. Some of them you'll have heard of, depending on where you're from, right? So within the OPC and those areas, some of you will have heard about Cornelius Van Til. Some of you will have heard about Jay Adams. Some of you will have heard about Tim Keller, maybe. Only had some best-selling books. There's significant notable faculty, notable alumni as well. These people, while not all directly influenced by Machen himself, so Machen was dead by the time Keller was teaching classes there, but that work that he started influenced them, and the OPC and Westminster Seminary still do pay great honor and respect and to Machen. They claim to still be influenced by him and carrying forward his vision. If you want to read those later, just Google Westminster Seminary and that'll come up on Wikipedia. But who did he... So that's... to go back, the OPC still exists, is very influential. Westminster Seminary itself is extremely influential. In fact, allegedly or reportedly, you can see it in the... It's not allegedly, it's reported in the book, but there's no direct citation. R.C. Sproul himself said that every great evangelical leader in his lifetime had some connection to Westminster Seminary. So that's how... So he's not talking about just Presbyterian. Sproul had contacts all over in many different streams of evangelical Christianity. And Sproul himself said that every great leader that he had known in his lifetime had some connection to Westminster Seminary or the OPC. So now let's look, though, at some of the other streams. Harold Ockingay was a student of Machen's at Princeton and at Westminster. So he left Princeton with Machen and went to be a student at Westminster. He eventually becomes pastor of Park Street Church in Boston, still an evangelical church in Boston today. He becomes the first president of the National Association of Evangelicals. So if you remember from last week, we say that the fundamentalists and the new evangelicals split in the 50s. So the new evangelicals form this group, the National Association of Evangelicals. Ockingay is one of the leaders. He's on the board. He was on the boards of Christianity Today and the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. He was involved in founding and being president at both Fuller Seminary in California and Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary on the East Coast. These are hugely significant institutions in shaping 20th and 21st century Christianity. He himself was not in the Presbyterian Church after this time, but was in these interdenominational evangelical organizations. What George Marsden would call, he's a card-carrying evangelical. He's someone whose theological, religious, ministerial work is in this trans-denominational coalition that's usually identified with Billy Graham and Fuller Seminary. Another student of Machen's at Princeton and Westminster was a guy named Carl McIntyre. He founded the Bible Presbyterian Church and the Faith Seminary that was associated with it. While Ockingay was the head of the NAE, McIntyre became the head of the American Council of Christian Churches and the International Council of Christian Churches, which were the fundamentalist versions. And all of these were to be evangelical or fundamentalist counterpoints to the National Council of Churches, which was liberal. So he becomes a very big shot in fundamentalism. He's also pretty much single-handedly... He's the ringleader of cantankerousness in the fundamentalist movement. Toward at one point in his life, he was renting a ship and had a radio station so he could broadcast out in sea because he was in a fight with the FCC, things like that. But he was very much so. This was a man, though. This Faith Seminary is where Francis Schaeffer went to seminary after he left. Schaeffer started at Westminster and then moved to Faith. And Schaeffer was very much involved in the work of the Bible Presbyterian Church that McIntyre founds. And years later, when Schaeffer is having his crises of faith, a lot of it has to do with the attitude, demeanor, approach that they had been taking under the leadership of Carl McIntyre. Another leader is J. Oliver Buswell. He was not one of Machen's students ever, but he helped Machen form the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, the organization that got Machen kicked out. He was involved with Machen in founding the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. He then later left with McIntyre to help found the Bible Presbyterian Church. He later left and went to the RPCES that I mentioned, which eventually joined the PCA. He's a very significant person. There's a library named after him at Wheaton. There's Wheaton College. There's a library named after him at Covenant Seminary. He becomes the dean both at Covenant College and Covenant Seminary, which were at the time the college and seminary of the RPCES, which then came into the PCA. I'm not sure why I put that up there again, other than to say, you can see, if you want to see, here's the Northern Presbyterian Church, here's the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, here's the Bible Presbyterian Church, here's what becomes the RPCES. So Buswell went on each one of those rides, right? And another person who is influenced by the work of Machen and his students is Kenneth Cancer. He attended Faith Seminary like these, that Buswell and McIntyre founded. He becomes a professor at Wheaton. He became a leader in the Evangelical Free Church. So now we're leaving Presbyterianism. He eventually becomes the dean of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. You might have heard it called TEDS. And eventually the editor of Christianity Today and the president of the Evangelical Theological Society. So we've got Bible Presbyterians, we've got E-Free. Vernon Grounds also attended Faith Seminary, became a leader in the Conservative Baptist Church. So they mentioned to you, Presbyterians aren't the only ones that split. The Northern Baptists also were having their splits. So in the 20s, a group called the Regular Baptists left. The conservative guys tried to stay, but they later actually left the Northern Baptists as well. And Vernon Grounds becomes a leader there, becomes president of their seminary, Denver Seminary, and later of the Evangelical Theological Society. Another guy, Joseph Bailey, also attended Faith Seminary. You may have heard of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. So he was the East Coast leader of InterVarsity here in America. He later becomes the director of InterVarsity Press, which was involved in printing and still is. But back in the day, many of us read many of their books. They also were involved in getting Francis Schaeffer published early on. It might have been the British wing, because Schaeffer then eventually moved over to Crossway. But he was head of InterVarsity Press, editor of their magazine called His Magazine, wrote a column for many years for Eternity Magazine, which was published by Donald Barnhouse, who is the pastor at 10th Presbyterian Church, and then eventually becomes the president of David C. Cook, which is still a large, influential Christian publishing house. And then Francis Schaeffer also attended Faith Seminary, became a leader in the Bible Presbyterian Church, but left it to found LaBrie, eventually became a leader in the RPCES, which then, of course, as I've mentioned, merged with the PCA. So with Schaeffer, I think we see this going out and coming back and learning. But as we read Machen, if you've read much of Schaeffer, I was repeatedly amazed at the arguments and the emphases that Schaeffer had picked up and was perpetuating from Machen's book. So who was J. Gresham Machen? Well, we've seen a little bit of who he was, and even though that was probably like, whoa, that was a lot, but that's still just a little. We've seen a little bit of his influence. In the coming weeks, though, let's see if we can consider his arguments. So hopefully knowing this background will help us understand his arguments. It won't lead us to just a priori think he's right or a priori dismiss him. Like let's engage the arguments. One of the beauties of this book is the arguments are accessible. They're really clear. It's really good, clear arguing and writing. Engage with it. Argue with the book. Write in the margins. See if you agree. See if you can refute him. In many cases, I don't know how anyone can, but you need to decide for yourself. So we're supposed to end right now, but I'll take one question or two. All right. Start reading the book. We'll start digging into the book next week. Have a great day.
Good job.